Safa Adam. Rebecca Grinspan. Ndidi Nuanelli. Our moderator, Maria Ido. Ladies and gentlemen, our working group chair, Gail Smith.
And I will say, one of the things we do to get ready for the high production values on this is go over everybody's names. And Ndidi, you have the best name of anybody on any panel. Everybody, I'd like to welcome you to a really important panel this afternoon. And just a quick announcement. This is not the panel where we talk about women and check that box. This is a panel where four people who are women are going to tell you about what we all need to know and understand and how we can really change the world. And as they speak, I'd like to ask you, because as you all know by now, the discussions will revert to all of you after about 30 minutes to do two things. You've got cards on your tables. If you have questions, write them down and pass them to your table facilitator. We'll do our best to get to some of them. We can't get to all of them, but we'll do our best to get to some. And as they speak, again, as we did in the last panel, really be thinking about solutions. They're going to describe challenges. They're going to describe opportunities. They're going to describe change. What we want you to do is help us all think about what the solutions might be. So I'm going to now turn this over to a very competent and very powerful woman and friend, Maria Idle, and have a great time.
Thanks, Gail. Well, good afternoon, everybody. It's pretty hard to shock a group like you with a statistic, especially when you've been sitting at the CGI, and in every session, someone comes up with another amazing statistic to wow you with. But think about this one. The Office of Development Assistance estimates that of international aid, all international aid in the world, there is only 0.6% of that that is specifically designed to address the issues of women and girls. So that's less than a cent directed to women and girls. So if you really think about it, that's half a cent for half the world's population. But at the same time, we're at a time of just unprecedented leadership, whether it's women in political or business or social aspects of the world, all over the globe. Investing in girls' education, for instance, we've all learned, is probably one of the most effective and fastest way to solve the issues of poverty. 7 years of education for a girl results in a girl getting married 4 years later, having two less children. When you educate a girl, HIV/AIDS rates go down and malnutrition decreases dramatically. So that's all undeniable, and it's very familiar, and it's such an incredible multiplier effect. Yet at the same time, investments are so modest. Those of us who invest in this field also know that when you invest in women and girls, that you have to actually make very specific and targeted, dedicated resources. Muhammad Yunus put some very dedicated resources behind this and won the Nobel Peace Prize. For microinsurance. So everybody knows that. But what is microinsurance? It's a massive investment in women as leaders of change, with over 80% of first-time borrowers being women. So half a cent for half the world's population, that's what we're here to talk about. Seems like there might be a little bit of a disconnect between the dialogue and the action around this issue. So today what we want to do as a panel, what we've been talking about, is we really want to redefine this issue. We want to reframe it. Traditionally, we think of women's issues as social issues, equity issues, and immediately think of issues like education. But today we want to redefine the issue. And when you dig deeper, it gets even more exciting because we see the world differently through different eyes. So, for example, so we get a sense of what we're going to talk about here today. If you think of adolescent girls as victims of their circumstance, it leads you to a certain conclusion and a certain set of responses. But if you think about adolescent girls as potential sources of economic growth and stability and peace and security,
and political progress, then that changes your frame of reference, and all of a sudden you're talking about the issue in a much broader context. So take an example of entrepreneurship, for example. If you invest in young women in entrepreneurship to make it appropriate, what you'll find is that other disadvantaged groups will benefit from that investment. So the point is, if we look at this issue through a different lens, we have the opportunity to see a whole host of solutions that we may not have considered before, and unleashing a whole different potential for the world. So today, that's what we're going to discuss, and I'm going to start by introducing Nandidi, who does have the best word name. She is the CEO of Leap Africa. She started four NGOs in her career, all of them focused on entrepreneurship and leadership, and bringing young women and girls to leadership positions in Nigeria. And Nandidi, maybe you could start off by telling us a little bit your story, but weave into it how your perceptions of the issues of women and girls have evolved over time.
Thank you very much. It's a wonderful pleasure to be here, and I have to say that I'm a very fortunate woman in that I was educated and had women mentor me, and I'm standing on the shoulders of other women who have gone before me. I'm from Nigeria. I grew up in Enugu, which is in the southeast of Nigeria, and I'm from a family of four girls and one boy, and I'll explain why that's relevant as I go along. I left Nigeria when I was 16 to basically come to the United States to get my education, and was working in the corporate world with McKinsey and was unfulfilled, because I felt that the issues that I was facing and my people were facing were a lot greater. And so I returned to Nigeria first in 1995, and then in 1998 I spent the summer in Ramallah working with Palestinian entrepreneurs, and one of them asked me, "What are you doing here helping us when your country is a mess?" And that really struck me and challenged me to go back and work with entrepreneurs in my own country. The first initiative I helped start was called Faith Foundation, and that works with young people and helps them start businesses. After working with Faith Foundation, I realized that there was a bigger challenge with the entrepreneurs, especially the women entrepreneurs. That challenge was that women entrepreneurs lacked access to linkages, market linkages, access to financing, and the opportunity to even work with amongst themselves. So I started an organization called Business Women's Network, which creates an opportunity for women to support each other, to trade with each other, and to gain access to other markets. I had a defining moment in October 2002 when I went to the AWID conference. Coming from the business world, there's a big gulf between women who are working in civil society and women who are in the corporate world. And so I was like a fish out of water. But I watched a movie there called Wishing for Seven Sons and One Daughter. And it really challenged me, because there's a missing middle. Women who have never made it into this world because they were terminated in the womb. I mentioned I was from a family of four girls and one boy. That night, I came up with an idea called NIA, an organization to support women in southeastern Nigeria who, unfortunately, struggle with some of the issues of confidence around their ability to be leaders. Why? Because in a part of the world, inheritance is still linked, a large degree, to male children. And a lot of women don't feel that they can achieve their highest potential. So I started an organization to work with women in universities to help them achieve their highest potential through mentoring, training, and linkages to positions in their universities. And one other organization I've started, which I run now, is called Leap Africa. And Leap works with both men and women on the issue of leadership. And what I say with Leap is that for our youth program, we're grooming the next president. We train our young people, and then we give them small grants to start change projects in their communities. So by learning, they gain access, they gain ideas. But by doing, by starting change projects, they learn that they can actually do it themselves. And that's what transforms their mindset. So what have I learned through this journey? I've learned that there's still a lot of challenges that women face around mindsets, around access, but that a large percentage of what will change our societies is getting more women into positions of authority and positions where they're running large corporations and where they have access to capital. Because I think that if we have the funds, we can change the system. Thank you.
Thank you. So if Nandini has the best name, Rebecca has really the longest title for sure. She is the Assistant Secretary General, Assistant Administrator, and Regional Director of the Regional Bureau for Latin America and the Caribbean at UNDP. Tell us your story.
It's interesting hearing Nidhi because I wanted to start saying that I was born in a middle-class family of Costa Rica and on a family of three daughters, and that also made a change for me. So it was interesting to hear your story too. And I really did believe that there were no obstacles additional to women vis-a-vis men. I really thought that if you are committed, if you work hard, you know, you will make it, and you can do it all. And at age 31, I became Undersecretary of Finance of my country with two little children, one a newborn. And after 2 years, I quit my job. I couldn't do it all. And I learned there that it's not true that there are no specific obstacles for women, and that it's not for us women or as individuals to look for our own solutions alone. It's for society to really take care of the obstacles we are facing. And that's really my main message. My message is that this is not only a matter of women for women to solve. This is a matter for society to solve. Because if I couldn't do it, then I had everything I needed to do it. So just imagine how many millions of women cannot give their talent, their creativity, their innovative ideas to really change the world because of the obstacles they face. And I really think that in looking for solutions to reconcile family and work for this new century, we really face most of the main challenge that society is facing right now. And we cannot do it alone. We need society to do it, we need businessmen to do it, we need the workplace, and we need society to help us doing that. And this is key to fight poverty. That is also one, you know, the challenge that this meeting is posing in front of us. Because women that cannot reconcile family and work, they go to the informal sector, they go to the low productivity sectors. They are overrepresented as poor, they are overrepresented in the informal sector, they are overrepresented as head of households, and they are underrepresented in the political sphere. And so those two things are connected, they are not independent. And so we have to really care. If we care about poverty, if we care about equality, if we really want to build a more equitable world, we really need to take care of these issues that are the issues of society. And for the moment, only women care about them. And so that's my message. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. So, Safa, if you want to hear about somebody who has guts, Safa is the person who has fought for peacekeeping and was actually the person who brought the diverse group of women, of NGOs, academia, government, and rebel movements to the table for the Darfur-Sudan peace talks. She has been a tireless warrior for peace talks, and she was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize for her incredible work. Could you tell us a little of your story, Safa?
Thank you. I have been honored to be in this gathering and to share my experience with you. My name is Safa Adam. I am a peace and gender activist from Sudan, from Darfur. And I was born in a small village called Ardamata in western Darfur, in a family of six daughters and two sons. And at the very early time, at 10 years old, I lost mother, and I found myself in a situation that my elder sister risked her education in order to keep the family sustained and we continue our education. I am lucky enough, I'm the first one who get higher education and to get to university. From that point that I found myself, education is the only way for me as a woman to change my life and also to get the voice of the other people and to be heard, because I know the voice of my sister there. No one, she is doing her best to sustain the family and to keep us to educated with my other sister and brothers and with other so many women in the society who get up very early from the morning. They try to preserve the family, try to get things done in terms of in the farm, go to the farm, and doing small business in the community that can provide education fees and clothes. And at the end of the day, we had this what's so-called economic development, because I think economic development from my perspective is that it is a sum and a total of this of these efforts of these people who sustain real life of people at the grassroots, like me, get education at the higher level, and I have a value and investment in my country. And being in this situation and seeing and have your education, seeing that the issue is more than just it's more than just it's a women issue. It is an issue of a voice of people who are in the grassroots levels, who don't have access to different economic facilities and social networks that can help them to draw their way. From that perspective, I found myself that I have to be the voice of these women, and I have to be the voice of the not hopeless, but they are hopeful people, but they need to be their voice to be heard.
Thank you. Safa, when you brought women to the peace table in Sudan, you said, "We women, we are one tribe. We don't have other tribes." Could you talk about what is it that women uniquely brought to this negotiation? And what is there that we can learn about, one, getting to the negotiating table, which was a major achievement in and of itself? What can we take from that, and what can we apply to other situations where we need to see women at the squarely at the table where decisions are made?
Okay, the negotiation table and this conflict is all about conflict over resources and power, and where it is male-dominated in most cases, as we to my experiences. They always describe women as victims of the war, and they have to be to wait and to see the results of this outcome of the negotiation. And the say and the voice is for the only for those who carry guns and who their voice heard by the international community or by the government or by whoever in power. While women, during that course, they are the manager of the results of this crisis, constitute 75 or 85% of the internally displaced camp, and try to sustain their lives with the support of the international community or with the aid, and try to fetch for basic needs, and And while the discussion about the whole issue of wealth sharing, economic and social justice is there on the table, and women are absent. And in that sense, we think that women are stakeholders. They are not victims because they have a voice to be heard. And they are not victims, but they are have been impacted differently in terms of the conflict. And unless their issue of economic impoverishment, because they are sustainers of these big camps, IDPs camps and the families and all these things, without, at the very beginning of the negotiation, unless their issue are central in the negotiation table, by the end of the negotiation, they will not find any room to put those issues, because it is all about the community, as Rebecca said that. The issue is not a woman issue. It is a community issue of how power sharing, economic sharing, wealth sharing, and the security arrangement, and all this, it is governing all of us. It is not just govern a specific group of the rebels or movement. From that perspective, we thought that we are not victims, we are not hopeless. We are the real stakeholders. Our voice has to be heard, and our issues, it has to be central at the negotiation table. And we started to advocate for that. And especially in a tribal society like Darfur, where, and even Sudan, most society are tribal, where there is no room for women. For the wealth sharing, it is a communal wealth sharing, and the power sharing, it is a tribal chief who is dominant the whole tribe. If even small tribes, they are hopeless in somehow. But and for the women, it is there is no room for them even to have access to such power. And then from that perspective, we think that we are citizenship. We have the right to sit into the negotiation table. It is not an easy thing to convince, but we use, we love it, and we network with international community, UN, and our sister organizations, and we use 1325 and other international machineries and mechanism, and we use our solidarity between us as women in Darfur itself, because we skip this issue of there is Janjaweed, there is, yes, it is hard at the bottom of the society that there is some there is a fragmentation, but we saw that we are going to live for a long time. We have to sustain life. Unless we unify and we make solidarities, we are not going to that table. But then women from different tribal affiliation, from different academic and research institute, human rights activists, women who have genuine work on the ground with the internet displaced, we came together and we just developed one specific goal, a common goal, which we are similar in all cases, that we are impoverished, we don't have a voice to be, and we need to have our voice to be heard. And we managed to get into the negotiation table with a team called Gender Expert Support Team, which has been recognized, and we developed a document called Darfur Women Priorities for Peace and Reconstruction.
I'm going to need to jump in.
Yeah.
Off. It's fascinating. I'm wondering if we can apply some of the same concepts that you're talking about, Rebecca, from your perspective. You have a unique perspective of this issue of being fully involved in the political and economic engines of decision-making. Can you speak to your perspective on that and where you see unique obstacles to that? What do we need to do to make that kind of full involvement really occur?
Yeah. Let me try to say there that probably one of the most difficult things is to really get the political will to change things. And though there is progress, there are more women president, there are more women in parliament. Still, for example, in Latin America, only 16% of parliamentarians are women. And we need to support them to have an agenda for equality, because many times they get elected to parliament, but there is no agenda to put forward and to change things for women in the country from that perspective. So it's not enough just to elect women. We need to work with them. We need to support them. We need to have an agenda. We need to back them up. Because sometimes we, as I encounter in my political career, the women expect that you will solve everything just because you are there. And you need to create a movement, you need to create support, you need to create networks, and you need other sectors of society really to back you up, you know, to be able to make a change. And change is slow, because it's not easy really to get to the backbone of this power. Power rules of the game, because at the end we are talking about power. We are talking about not having power over somebody, but have power to change things, to do things, to innovate, not over somebody, but to do things. And if we change that concept of power for men and women, because women use it too, you know, for men and women, maybe we can really make a difference. So let me try to sum up a little bit what you said, is that we need the political will, and to get the political will, we need to get the support of organizations, of different sectors of society, and we need to support women, the voice of women, in the communities, in the scientific areas, in all areas of society, just to change the notion, the values, the culture, that there really are great obstacles for women to get there.
Great. So let's go right to the on the ground where you're trying to do the work, Ndidi. What are the unique barriers, or what have you seen great innovation that breaks through those barriers and really creates a new reality, which is something that we can replicate and something that can be taken up to scale? We like to talk about scale, but we don't really see it happen in this area of women and girls. What could you say to that?
Okay. I think we can really push for scale, and we're starting to see scale in the area of women's education and women's health. And I think that we have examples on the ground, for example, in Nigeria, where northern women from mostly Muslim backgrounds who have been limited to Quranic education are getting access to education because women in their communities who have been educated are going and pulling them to school. And they're creating infrastructure, something as basic as toilets in these schools, where there were no toilets for young women before, have now created an opportunity for those women. In my work, what we've seen is by simply training women and mentoring women, they now came up with an idea for a big sister program where women in universities are now going to secondary schools, and each woman is taking a secondary school where she's mentoring another young woman. Because it's not enough for women to get university education. Many of them are getting university education, but they're not getting into the workplace, because their first role is to find a husband so they can secure their role in the family and to have a male child. So what we're doing is changing their mindset about what it means to get an education, and they are now touching the lives of millions of women. That's at the grassroots. Now, in the corporate world, I work with entrepreneurs, and our focus with our entrepreneurs is on succession. We're trying to get our male entrepreneurs to see their daughters as potential successors. We're also trying to get our women entrepreneurs to ensure that they have women on their boards, and that they have boards, and our male entrepreneurs to have women on boards. If you produce a product that serves primarily women, let's use Cadbury as an example. In Nigeria, Cadbury sells sweets. Who buys sweets? Women, mostly for their children. And yet Cadbury doesn't have a woman on its board. So that's a direct challenge to us in this room, to think about getting women in places of decision-making. Because if they're on boards, they'll affect CSR. They'll affect how your company uses its money. And they'll channel more of the money to the areas that we're talking about, women's issues. So we're starting to see some changes, but it's slow. And there's so much that needs to be done.
Could you speak a little bit to the issue of access to capital? I know when we all talked before, you all mentioned that.
Yes, that is something that's a huge issue. Women have been known to be very good at repaying their loans, and yet they cannot get access to capital because they don't own land, They have to have a husband to access loan in many parts of the world who will co-sign the loan, etc. And so what we're starting to see, and actually that's my CGI idea, is a fund that will focus on women, a private equity fund that will focus on women. Because I think that more women need help in getting access to larger capital. Microfinance has been successful, but it can only take us to a certain point. What we need are the next stages of financing. And my hope is that some of us will partner together to think about how we can do it across regions. Thank you.
Good. I see that we're almost out of time, and Gail's going to come up. But Rebecca, you had something that you thought was very important before we went to the table discussions that you thought that you wanted people to keep in mind.
Yeah, I really wanted to ask you to help us to find new solutions for this family work balance, because we know that care infrastructure is key, but it's not enough. We need to think again how we will for the future balance this issue for men and women of having a more work-life balance. If we don't solve this, we will continue to have problems, or families alone, or women without families going to work. So let's think a little bit what we can do in the workplace, what innovative solutions we can have, and let's bring the private sector to this discussion, because it's not only a public policy what we need. We need things to change in the workplace, and I really would appreciate if we can have some ideas around the meeting.
And we all had a resounding in our pre-discussion enthusiasm for making sure that this was about men and women coming up with solutions for women and girls. So back to you, Gail.
Thank you all very much. I'd like to heartily endorse the notion of solutions for work-life balance. And if you would send them to me at the Center for American Progress. No, but it's really important, because what all of our panelists are talking about are not women in isolation, but women as connected to everything we do and everything that makes development succeed or fail. And so let me join all of our panelists in asking you to now help think about solutions. And what are the solutions that can be brought to the table by the private sector, by civil society, by governments, by individuals, working alone or ideally together? And just based on what we've heard, in a couple of ways. One is in ways that can support women that are out in the forefront, or who has been suggested, secure a seat at the table, but then need an agenda and support behind them. What are the solutions that can help change institutions, to change the way they think, to transform? And Dita, you were talking about this in terms of where there are companies like Cadbury, who sell a lot of sweets to me, and I do not have children, they are just for me. They don't have a woman on the board. And also in access. How do you come up with solutions that provide women with access to the table, like Safa achieved, but then back them while they're there and empower them to carry out what's decided at that table? So if you'd focus on solutions, we're going to turn to you now, and then we will be coming back to our panel. You all have facilitators, and we encourage you to be as creative as you absolutely can. So thank you very much, and it's all yours.